Please note that the views expressed on this program are those of the individuals who speak them, and not necessarily those of Portsmouth Community Radio, its Board of Trustees, members, volunteers, or underwriters. Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. And good evening once again, and welcome to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. I am your host, Willie Hassel, your gatekeeper to the dark side, your guide to the realm of the unknown, the unseen, the unthinkable. And yes, she is here, and she is always the lovely. She is the mystical and the, oh, so mysterious, Lynn Nickerson. Good evening, Lynn.
Good evening, Willie. And how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Wasn't so warm today, but the other day I had the first top-down ride in the Z3.
Yeah.
It's like summer. It's going to be warm again tomorrow.
Well, I think spring has finally arrived. We had one beautiful day. Well, how hot did it get? About 82 or something? It was really warm.
About 85 a couple of days ago.
Was it 85? Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on where you were standing because it's a bit cooler at the beach, but
absolutely,
it was gorgeous.
But I bet it's at least that warm, if not even warmer, where tonight's guest is.
I bet he's nice and toasty.
Because I believe he is in Texas, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong. But anyways, tonight's guest is Ken Gerhard, and Ken is widely recognized cryptozoologist and field investigator for the Center for Fortean Zoology, as well as a fellow of the Pangaea Institute and consultant for various anomalous research organizations. He has searched the world for evidence of strange and legendary beasts. Ken has been featured on such TV shows as History Channel's Monster Quest, the Travel Channel's Legend Hunters, Science Channel's Unexplained Files, National Geographic's Paranatural, and Sci-Fi's Weird or What with William Shatner. And he is joining us tonight on Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, to talk about his latest book, Encounters with Flying Humanoids. So please, let us welcome to Spirit Radio, Ken Gerhard. Good evening, Ken.
Hi, Ken.
Hey, guys.
How are you?
And thanks so much for having me on. It's definitely a pleasure and an honor to be here tonight.
Same thing. Ditto.
Well, yes, we thank you very much for joining us.
So tell me, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Or what do you want to be when you grow up?
Well, you just seem to jump into cryptozoology, but what were you planning on doing?
Wow. Definitely not this. Probably not in my wildest dreams. Like most kids, I was probably changing my vocational dreams every year or so. But I remember my mother, who was a big influence on me, she wanted me to be a writer and an archaeologist. And she would always take me on these fabulous vacations to different ruins around the world. So I got to go to Machu Picchu.
She was very instrumental in opening
Mexico, and she always wanted, it was fascinating, but I was typically more interested in legendary creatures and different mystery beasts and things. So I guess in kind of a roundabout way, I ended up on this path that I'm on. But Gosh, yeah. Certainly, cryptozoology is not a career that you should plan for, I guess.
but it's one you just
do these days. But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a career you just kind of fell into, and it's working out very well, I would say.
Well, yes, but his mother brought him to so many different places.
Oh, it really stimulated
his your education and your quest to learn. Don't you think, Ken?
You know, I think I guess it's appropriate since it's Mother's Day weekend. I'm sure everyone up there has very fond memories of the growing up and the type of influence that their mother had on them. And in my case, my mother was adventurous and she loved to travel around the world. And she definitely had an influence in terms of what I do now, investigating these mysteries.
Oh yeah, did you ever teach?
No, I've never taught.
No. Well, let me see. Not only did I read your book, I loved it, absolutely loved it, and I kept drawing parallels to you and Linda Godfrey. Have you heard of her?
Oh, yeah, Linda. Yeah, she's a good friend of mine.
Oh, is she really?
Yeah, wonderful researcher.
Well, you both, yeah, she's impeccable research, too. But you both touch on these very strange aspects of creatures of the earth. And before we can draw conclusions at the end of the hour, but can you give me an indication if you think that a lot of these creatures were originally here on the earth?
Ah, well, that's kind of an interesting question. You know, first of all, we have to make some clarifications because a lot of people aren't really familiar with what cryptozoology represents. It's kind of a niche field at this point.
But it is.
Cryptozoology, the definition is hidden. Crypto is hidden from Latin, and zoology, of course, pertaining to animals. So we're talking about hidden animals. And the field of cryptozoology was actually started by a couple of zoologists back in the 1950s and 60s. Bernard Hoovelmans and Ivan Sanderson are kind of recognized as the fathers of cryptozoology. And they were traditional scientists, but they were the kind of guys that thought outside the box a little bit. So they were, they were definitely onto something in terms of, maybe there were different species around the planet that hadn't been discovered yet. There are new animal species, of course, being discovered all the time, and encounters with these aloof and enigmatic species might account for some of our quote-unquote monster legends.
Yeah.
But then you also have kind of this gray area in terms of mysterious creatures that probably do not fit into the paradigm of what we, see as our natural world. And in that particular category, I always put the flying humanoids, of course, which I've written about, and other types of fabulous creatures like Linda Godfrey's dogman / werewolf.
Yep, upright canids.
Basically, goat men, things that don't have any, that don't make any sense from an evolutionary standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're not going to go back in the fossil history and find a hominid, a man-like form with wings or with a fish's tail, that's just not how we evolved. So these are they're almost like mythological beasts that have kind of stepped right out of the books, the mythology books, into modern times because people do report encounters with these creatures and we just don't know what they are.
And I don't think we still know what they are, do we? Even after the sightings.
We can speculate. That's going to be the fun part tonight.
Yeah.
A lot of what we do in this field is speculation because we just don't know.
Well, then how about, let's start off with the Batman creatures. They've got the appearance of being humanoid, and then they've got these leathery bat wings.
Yeah.
Now, how do you suppose that evolved? Where do you suppose that came from? They can't all be bad experiments. Experiments gone bad by the government.
Yeah, well, you can have fun with a lot of different theories, speculations. Now, my gut instinct is that these creatures, and they do seem to represent physical characteristics that are indicative of known species. So, yeah, you mentioned the man-bat type creatures.
Mm-hmm.
They're flying humanoids that have these leathery bat-like wings. Kind of membranous wings that we see on a bat. Again, there's nothing really in the natural world that would indicate that a humanoid would have evolved with wings. So let's look at other theories. And of course, there are people that are going to say that these are some type of diabolical, the result of some kind of diabolical scientific experiment. There are many people that like to talk about them being, quote-unquote, interdimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're extraterrestrial. Maybe they're from another planet or another realm of existence or dimension of reality. And then, you know, there's those that think that maybe these are, although they do display physical properties, that maybe their origin is more nefarious. Maybe they are metaphysical in origin, you know, spirit forms, more or less, that are able to manifest into our world in a physical way. So
that does account for a lot of the sightings, if that's the case.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of take your pick. But one of the really frustrating things about the flying humanoid phenomenon is that there are so many different types of descriptions.
There are, I know it.
You know, and compared to something that's more traditional in the field of cryptozoology, let's take a look at something like Bigfoot or lake monsters that are reported around the world. In those cases, you have a lot of consistency. You know, eyewitnesses from different backgrounds, seemingly unrelated, describe basically the exact same physical characteristics. So that obviously is very promising when you're looking at an archetype and saying, okay, well, this animal does exist. What could it be? But in terms of the flying humanoids, you have all these diverse descriptions. You have the Mothman, you have the Owlman, you have the Batman, and you have the Birdmen, which are more of like feathered with bird-like characteristics. And so it's really hard to kind of come up with one catch-all to what these things are. They obviously, they're, you know, they come in many different shapes and sizes, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Which way do you lean towards, Ken? Interdimensional or possible extraterrestrial? What do you think?
Any of the above, you know, and I think that we're kind of, oftentimes we're dealing with semantics when we talk about interdimensional versus extraterrestrial, and people with spiritual beliefs say that they're demonic. You know, the bottom line is they did not evolve here on this planet the way that other life forms have evolved.
Right.
Well put.
So they're not flesh and blood in the way that we know them. As far as where they come from, you know, that is something that's, you know, kind of hard to wrap your head around, you know. I guess if we are being visited from extraterrestrials, then there's definitely a possibility that they're from another planet. If you believe string theory and think that there are other dimensions that we don't see all the time, you know, the fourth, fifth dimensions, maybe they come from there. You know, maybe they come from beyond. I mean, I can't really say, you know, if I have a personal favorite there.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of those terminologies that we're using there basically indicate the same thing, you know.
Yeah, you're right. Linda did mention that some of these upright canids that she had seen, some of them seemed to disappear right in front of some of the people's eyes. And some of the indication was that one of them was communicating with one of the witnesses, and the being implied that he was from the Earth and that he was an ancient race that was there before humans were. And it's a well-known fact now that there's a tunnel system under the Earth. So it could very, very well be that there was something else here before the humans were seated on Earth. But how many of these creatures are of that realm of the interdimensional, you know, where did they come from? I don't imagine that they're all creatures that were here before humans were, but there's so many different possibilities.
There are antediluvian, like you said.
Yes.
Ancient. But, you know, there's kind of the similarities there from what Linda investigates in these flying humanoids, because the flying humanoids, you know, they vanish into thin air. They're able to fly at impossible speed.
That's right. That's another.
You know, they seem to behave in a way where they're almost wanting to interact with us, really frighten us and terrify us, because they're usually, most of the accounts are of them chasing people or chasing people.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that is there are no accounts of them actually catching anybody and harming anybody.
Yeah, that is
so
interesting.
Like, you know, I think I draw this parallel in my book that they don't seem like they're feeding off of our emotions, you know, like psychic vampires.
Yeah.
They get life from our fear, and I think that's probably very similar in terms of the encounters with Linda's werewolves.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to have to tempt them, though, and get real close and find out.
don't want to test the theory, huh?
No. So the Batman, do you think that there's it is the result of like a bad experiment?
Oh, I don't think I personally think that.
No?
You know, I've never been a big fan of conspiracy theories. I know a lot of people are really are into those, and they're very prevalent, and a lot of times they're not easy to prove or disprove. But the reason I don't think that is that basically, in my experience, in the course of my life, people are very bad at keeping secrets.
Yeah.
Whenever people talk about these vast conspiracies, it's like, well, you know, you'd have to have so many people keep that secret. Or we'd all find out about it, and I just don't think that.
No, that, you tell.
Now, if you want to talk about aliens, then again, a lot of people, you know, think that we're basically being visited and interacted with by these extraterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial intelligences. Well, if they're advanced enough to come to our world from another dimension, from another planet, then perhaps they are advanced enough to do some kind of wild genetic experimentation that we can't even conceive of, you know? So I guess that.
It's always a possibility.
So I guess that would be possible.
Would you like to get into the history of the Mothman a little bit?
Oh, gosh. Yeah,
The Mothman.
You treated a large part of the book to the Mothman, so I was hoping maybe you'd like to talk.
Yeah, Mothman is an iconic figure, and I think probably, you know, even before I wrote the book on the flying humanoids, you know, more people asked me about Mothman, you know, as a sense of curiosity. But Mothman is basically, you know, one of the most enigmatic and notorious figures in the annals of the unexplained. He's described as a winged man-like creature standing about 5 to 6, maybe 7 feet tall, with enormous bat-like wings attached to his back. Most eyewitnesses have described Mothman as being completely headless, having a low slung head with 2 very large eyes set in its shoulder area. And the most startling feature are the eyes. They're described as giant red embers like automobile reflectors. And reportedly, they have a hypnotic power over humans. Pretty scary stuff. You know, one eyewitness claimed that they were paralyzed by Mothman's stare and actually collapsed onto the ground and were in a trance. In other instances, motorists have been chased by Mothman at speeds approaching 100 miles an hour.
Mm.
The descriptions obviously don't fit with anything we know of in the natural world. We already talked about that. So, you know, in my opinion, Mothman is a monster in the truest sense of the word. You know, it's seemingly a creature that stepped right out of a science fiction movie, and its sole purpose seems to be to chase and terrify humans, quite possibly leaving a wake of destruction in its path. Most people blame Mothman for the tragedy of the Silver Bridge collapse. Now, this all transpired in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, which is a sleepy little town in western West Virginia, right across the Ohio River from Ohio. And this is where Mothman was first encountered back in 1966, November 15, 1966 to be exact. And for 1 year and 1 day after that, until this terrible Silver Bridge collapse, there were many, many reports of the Mothman around Point Pleasant area, some as far away as Charleston. And there are people, of course, that claim to still see the Mothman. But most of the sightings that we know of happened in 1966-67. And, you know, if you're familiar with Point Pleasant, West Virginia, then you know that they also have an annual Mothman Festival every September.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big deal there. There's a museum and a statue in the town square, and so they've definitely embraced, the community there has embraced Mothman as part of their culture. But it's a really weird, creepy, and fascinating story, and one that we...
It is creepy. Do you think that it was actually a precursory event, the sighting of the Mothman repeatedly before the Silver Bridge collapse. You don't think that he was instrumental in it happening, do you?
That's what I was inferring. I mean, I'm not sure I would say that, but there are many people that I've interviewed in Point Pleasant. To this day, they still feel that, like, there is a connection. You know, because, you know, the Mothman, of course, probably one of the most important things that's ever happened in the history of that area. That was in 1966-67.
Mm-hmm.
And the bridge collapse on December 15, 1967. 46 people died. And sightings of the Mothman dramatically diminished right after that. So, you know, that's why a lot of people feel that these flying humanoids are representative of tragedy, that they are essentially harbingers or omens of cataclysmic events.
But wasn't it actually proven, though, in the investigation afterwards that there was a structural problem with the bridge?
I believe that, I think you're right on there. First of all, it was a very old bridge.
Yeah.
Had been probably used way past its expectancy. And it was also, constantly freezing and, thawing out every winter.
Yeah.
And, it was just a combination of a lot of traffic. But, yeah, I think you're right. There was a piece in that bridge that was faulty or maybe not made to last there. So.
Yeah, but it just sounds much better to blame it on the Mothman, though.
Well, my general feeling was that it was a precursor, a harbinger of something to come, but not necessarily the cause. But you kind of think that there's a connection to the cause with these sightings?
I can't say that I necessarily believe that, but, I do write about it in the book. There have been allegations, unconfirmed allegations, that flying humanoids like Mothman have been sighted, before other catastrophes like 9/11.
Really?
The Japanese tsunami / nuclear disaster, Chernobyl. You'll find they're very vague references online that people claim that they saw flying humanoids right before these catastrophes, but it's never been proven. I think the things that I found in antiquity that kind of, lend something to that theory are, for example, in ancient Assyrians, they worshipped a flying humanoid-type god named Pazuzu.
Yes.
And Pazuzu, or Zu, was basically a bad omen. If Pazuzu appeared, it meant that there was going to be a famine or flood or disease or some disaster.
Wasn't that the creature in Ghostbusters? Wasn't that the creature in Ghostbusters?
I think we're actually, it was in The Exorcist.
That Sigourney Weaver turned into? I thought that was her character, wasn't it?
Maybe right. I'm not as well versed as Ghostbusters.
Shame on you.
Turn up in as the antagonist in The Exorcist.
Yeah.
In Scotland you have a legend of a creature known as the Scree. And the Scree is basically a flying witch-like creature that said to appear before, bloody battles or train disasters. You have different legends around the world that kind of refer to these flying humanoids as harbingers of cataclysmic events. Moreover, you have the owls, which, I think owls have perhaps some relevance in the mystery as well. People have suggested that the Mothman, some sightings of Mothman may be misidentifications of owls, or that there could be a gigantic species of owl out there that we haven't discovered yet.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cultures, I found that the appearance of an owl outside someone's window, for example, often is interpreted as meaning that someone's going to get sick or there will be a death in the family or something like that. So.
Well, then, getting back to 9/11, have you heard anything specifically, Ken, about sightings before 9/11 of any flying humanoids?
Nothing specific, no. All I heard was I've read very vague references online, but typically there's no source. It comes across as a rumor.
Yeah.
There are no specific details to back any of that up.
Another thing, too, once people spotted the Mothman, generally speaking, either they got ill or they were pursued by men in black, and they were eventually either silenced or they seemed to have died of natural causes. It's like they want
to... that's true to some degree. There was a woman, John Keel, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, was the author of the Mothman Prophecies. He was an investigator of UFOs and demons and all types of unexplained phenomenon, but he had teamed up with a local reporter named Mary Heyer, and she was basically she was well connected in that area in Point Pleasant, knew everyone there, and so she was able to kind of get John in some doors that he might not have gotten in otherwise. So they partnered up for a while. And Mary did claim that she was visited by men in black, as did John Keel. And she also died sort of prematurely.
Really?
Very tragically, died of cancer at a young age. Now, Lauren Coleman, who's one of my colleagues in the field of cryptozoology, believes that there is a death curse associated with Mothman. Like, maybe I shouldn't say he believes that, but he has printed a list of 60-some names of people that were somehow associated with the Mothman, either witnesses, relatives of witnesses, or people that had written books or, you know. So
really?
So, you know, many of those people died prematurely as well.
Does he have a pub?
There's a belief there that there is a curse. Now, this goes back to the something known as the Chief Cornstalk Curse. I don't know if you want me to mention that or not, but in the area around Point Pleasant, West Virginia, there was a legend that revolves around a famous Shawnee chief that lived during the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known as Chief, I can't pronounce his Shawnee name, but his Chief Cornstalk was kind of the anglicized version. And, you know, prior to that time, the state of West Virginia was largely unpopulated by Native tribes, but there were some Shawnee in the area around the 18th century. And it was this Shawnee chief was basically betrayed and murdered by white soldiers and so on his deathbed, he cursed the entire region. And since that time, you know, they've had the Mothman appearance and the Silver Bridge collapse and things like that. So there are many people that think that that area in general was cursed long before Mothman even appeared.
Well, that kind of makes sense, because a lot of these places, the ground desert is cursed, or the Native Americans are scared of a certain area.
Yeah, and then just briefly, just jumping back to Linda, you know, she definitely has found a potential connection between the Dog Man and some of these other weird creatures she's investigated, and sort of spirit effigy mounds that have been found in Wisconsin. So there could potentially be a connection between these Native American. Sacred Native American areas and perhaps some of these weird creature sightings.
And one of the characteristic too is often there is a body of water, either rivers, lakes, usually it's moving water, where there are these sightings. Haven't you found that to be true?
Water. Water is, that's true. Water is kind of symbolic in terms of, you know, places where all types of anomalous events take place. Not just weird creature sightings, but UFO reports and hauntings and spirit activity and things like that.
Yeah, that's true.
From a zoological point of view, you know, when I'm out tracking things like Bigfoot, which I believe is a flesh and blood thing, you're around the water there as well, because obviously all living things
need water. Yeah.
So I guess water in the big picture is an energy source. You mm-hmm. know? And so it would make sense on many levels that you would have all types of things happen around water.
Ken, we are now at the bottom of the hour. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes, and then we can discuss a little bit more about gargoyles and griffins and whatever else you'd like to bring up. Okay,
sounds great.
Good. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Supernatural Magazine, the UK's newest paranormal magazine, provides support to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. You are listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience on WSCA 106.1 FM, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You are listening to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience on WSCA 106.1 FM in Portsmouth's West End. And a little note from the community calendar, the Albacore Museum in Portsmouth, which has been shut down for maintenance, is open again. The USS Albacore submarine was built in Portsmouth and has been converted into a museum located at 600 Market Street. Year-round guided tours are available, and the museum also offers group rates. Museum hours are 9:30 to 4 p.m. through Memorial Day and 9:30 to 5 p.m. during the summer. Further information is available online at ussalbacore.org. And now for some upcoming guests to the show.
Okay, for our future guests, starting with May 16th, we're welcoming back Brad Olson. He's the author of Sacred Places Europe, 108 Destinations. May 23rd, Steve Parsons will be back. He's the creator of Parascience, and he'll be joining us from England to discuss his latest book, which has been co-written with Cal Cooper. And it focuses on infrasound as applied to paranormal investigation. May 30th, the title of our show is Ghosts of Hollywood and Curses, with Wes S. Nickerson III. He's a former writer for the HBO series Entourage, and more recently he's a writer-producer on Showtime's House of Lies. On June 6th, we are... we've just booked Trish Lesage, and she is interested in time slips, dimensions, and past lives. And I guess she's written a couple of books on that. June 13th, we're welcoming Artie Six Killer Clark, and she has just written a book called Sky People. And June 20th is a special two-hour show with Shane Serwa from True Ghost Paranormal Investigations. And we're also... welcoming Paul and Ben Eno back, and we'll all be discussing the Connecticut Triangle in Litchfield, Connecticut, and all of those people are appearing as investigators in a book written by Bill Hall, and Bill will be actually one of our guests in August, just about the time that his book will be released, so this will be showcasing what is found in that book. And we've got a couple of bookings in July, August, and September to be revealed at a later time.
To be revealed at a later time. So, right now, let's go back to the phone with tonight's guest, Ken Gerhard.
Hi, Ken. Welcome back.
Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you. Great to be here again. Got a lot of more stuff to talk about, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you have a direction that you'd like to go in? I know I've got a couple of questions, but would you like to take the floor?
No, go for it.
Okay. How about the flying humanoids of Mexico? Did you watch any of those clips on the internet about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of weird
videos
on YouTube of these flying humanoids in Mexico. And in fact, I just got had a gentleman send me one from San Diego, California, about a week ago that looks very reminiscent. They're brand new, but... these are a completely different type of flying humanoids in terms of
cryptozoology.
We have evidence that there's something going on because we can see these things kind of mm-hmm. floating around up in the air. But, of course, what's really striking about them is that they don't have wings.
Yeah, I know. They have little battery packs or something.
That are floating high up in the air. You can see, you know, typically on most of them, they're so high up you can barely see them. And people that have filmed them, they've had to zoom way in to get any kind of image. But... you know, you can interpret many of them as looking like they have a head,
mm-hmm.
two arms, a body, and two legs, you know, dangling down. So what they don't appear to have is any way to stay airborne. You know, these aren't men with jet packs on. They don't have, you know, dangled paragliders or anything like that. So they're
some
just
of
kind
them...
of hovering up high in the air and sometimes moving around. And you're right, most of these have been documented in Mexico starting about the year 2000, which is
yeah.
a big year in terms of UFO sightings in Mexico. Hmm. And they've periodically been turning up. And like I said, a brand new one from San Diego. I don't know what they are. I guess I would probably connect those more to UFO.
Extraterrestrial.
Than any of the other types, just because they have often been filmed and sighted in areas where there have been high levels of UFO activity.
Yeah, especially too, since they don't have the wings on them, so they don't really fall into the cryptozoology category.
Yeah, and you know, right. Some people that have seen them a little closer, you know, or close enough, said that they appeared almost like they were men wearing some type of suit.
Yeah,
you know, like almost like a flight suit or an astronaut type of suit. So you know, I guess you know if you wanted to, you know, so they're not animals, obviously.
Well,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, they have nothing to do with cryptozoology.
Right.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't rule out the possibility that they are humans that are involved in some type of experimentation. You know, maybe it's a government, military type thing that they're experimenting some type of new suit or something like that. I guess you couldn't rule that out.
Yep.
But they appear to be wearing suits and soaring up in the air, high up in the atmosphere.
It's so bizarre to watch them.
Weird stuff.
Yeah, very weird stuff. Well, then getting back to some of the other flying humanoids, there is quite a variety of sightings. Have you got any idea why there might be such a variety? Different descriptions.
Well, you know, again, that's really kind of a frustrating.
It is.
But I guess I would say the fact that there are so many different descriptions of these entities, whatever they are, might indicate that this phenomenon is somehow connected to us as humans and to specifically to individuals and, you know, individuals with different perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a way, if this is kind of like a phenomenon that comes from within us, you know, in a way, I think I kind of, you know, use an example in the book that it's almost as if, you know, we are somehow creating these beings from the deep recesses of our mind and that we're giving them physical properties, that we're actually giving them life and somehow projecting them onto the fabric of our reality.
Do you believe that?
And if that's the case, then it would make sense that there are so many different descriptions because, you know, people would tend to, you know, draw from their own experience to basically create these things, whatever they are.
But do you believe that, Ken? Do you think
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
I think...
You know, I try to stay as objective as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not trying to get myself off the hook here, but in terms of a mystery like this, I think that my honest opinion is that phenomenon like this is so far beyond our realm of understanding as beings that we could not even begin to grasp what's going on.
It's hard to categorize it.
And a lot of things that are going around us in our universe are far beyond our ability to comprehend. This is another example of that. It's something that, you know, either it's a extraterrestrial presence, like we talked about, something that's visiting us from another world, from another dimension, and doing things that we probably can't even comprehend, or it is a psychological phenomenon. And that doesn't mean that it's a hallucination, per se, or something that's a delusion, but it could be something that is physical in form, but it is basically given life from us, you know, from our conscious mind. But I don't have a strong opinion either way. I just don't think there's enough data to
draw conclusions. There was one very interesting account. A lot of them are fascinating, but this really hit home for some reason. Two gentlemen, a father and a son, and I believe this happened in Colorado. They were musicians, guitar players in, I believe it was Colorado, and something... there was a flying creature that came around their car. It made them both very sick for days. They vomited immediately.
Yeah, I think you're referring to, it was actually in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin?
The man bat of Briggs Road.
Yeah, that was so weird.
Again, this is Linda Godfrey was actually the one that investigated this case because she's up there in Wisconsin and she was contacted. But you're pretty much right on there with the other aspects. There were two gentlemen living in Wisconsin. They are Native American origin.
That's right.
But they also are musicians. They played together in a band, and they were on their way home from a rehearsal one night, and they claimed that this creature that was basically like a man-bat type of creature dive-bombed their car. And this happened on September 26, 2006. About 9:30 p.m. and the location was at Holman, Wisconsin, which is kind of, I think, near La Crosse. So these two Cherokee men One was 53 years old, and his son, both musicians, headed home from band practice, and they claimed this thing dive-bombed their car. They described it as having the features of both a bat and a man, with a wingspan of about 12 feet, and very terrifying experience. And after this thing took off, it left. They said that it emitted this horrible high-frequency shriek.
Oh.
And that it was just resonating in their ears. And driving down the road a little ways, they actually had to pull over, and they both became physically ill.
Mm-hmm.
And after they got home, they also claimed that they were having weird experiences around their house, almost like poltergeist activity, objects moving, banging noises on the outside, and things like that. So I think this kind of ties back to what you were talking about earlier, that some people that have had these flying humanoid encounters have claimed that they've had other kind of psychic backlash,
mm-hmm.
you know, in their lives, and in many cases have gotten ill as well.
So do you think that's like a psychological manifestation?
Yeah, it could be a psychological. It could be a form of possession. You know, not that I'm necessarily, that's something that I'm knowledgeable about or a strong proponent of.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's a form of attachment, right? People have had, perhaps if they've had connection or an encounter with one of these things, and it is basically a form of negative energy, that somehow this negative energy is able to attach to these people, and that, you know, it basically, it's like being infected in a way, you know. And they carry this attachment with them. So maybe by saying possession, maybe that's a little bit extreme. But I think the word attachment, I think, would be an appropriate thing.
Well, maybe there is something out in the ethers that they draw to them, but when you have a mass sighting and everybody sees the same thing, is there really such a thing as a mass hallucination?
That's
Do you think?
You know what? Again, a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I've heard that there is potentially such a thing as a mass hallucination. And, of course, a lot of that goes back to, Carl Jung and Jungian theory of
symbolism,
global consciousness, that all humans are connected somehow on different levels, and that we share this kind of common thread and common bond.
Mm.
But generally speaking, I say mass hallucination is not a good explanation, you know, from a scientific perspective.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be my first option in any situation. You know, if you had multiple eyewitnesses, that's usually a very strong case in terms of corroboration.
Yeah, it is.
You know, typically, hallucinations, you don't think of those as being mass hallucinations.
Good. I'm glad you said that.
you feel better now?
Yeah, I do. I feel better now.
Good.
Because I just can't believe these people are making all of it up. I mean, some people may misidentify, and sometimes it's dark, so you can't see really clearly. So, again, misidentification. But some of them are so... it's so well corroborated, and they all have to seem to say the same things and the same characteristics. So you can't discount everything.
No, absolutely not. I'm definitely open to definitely an open-minded person, or I wouldn't be following this investigation.
Yeah.
But one of the things that kind of frustrates me is, the people that have claimed that the Mothman was basically a misidentification of an owl.
Seven-foot owl?
Specifically a Bard's owl, which is an owl that has kind of a red glow to its eyes. But, you know, these are owls. Owls can get pretty darn big, but
yeah.
Nothing close to what people have been describing in terms of the Mothman. I mean, a tall owl is maybe 2 feet off the ground. And now, you know, people are describing something that's 6-7 feet tall. I mean, how could you possibly make that kind of mistake, anybody?
And the Mothman being so humanoid.
Something like Mothman.
Yeah, I just don't see the connection. It harkens back to the Thunderbird. That's like a huge, huge bird. And apparently it still does exist, but you can still see that it's a bird. I just don't see the correlation between Owlman and Mothman, logically.
No.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of a stretch,
yeah.
You know, a 7-foot tall owl.
Well, Ken, how about, this is changing gears a little bit, gargoyles and griffins. You had a wonderful story in there about the Brentford griffin in England.
Yeah.
So,
well, some people may think that I maybe were stretching things a little bit farther in terms of getting gargoyles and griffins involved in this flying humanoid nonsense, but I wanted to expand the scope of the book as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like there were actually some similarities in terms of accounts of gargoyle-like creatures, griffin-like creatures around the world, and, you know, and the flying humanoids in many respects. So the Brentford Griffin is a great story in England. In a suburb, there's a suburb of London known as Brentford. It's on the western side, I believe. And in 1986, I believe, there were some sightings of a creature that was described as a griffin. Now, a griffin, of course, from mythology, is basically a chimera, a mixture of different animal characteristics,
mm-hmm.
A quadruped, a four-legged animal, typically like something like a lion with eagle-like wings, or some people have portrayed it as having an eagle's head as well. But the Brentford Griffin was first reported in...
I think 1984. First reported.
1984, that's right.
Lately, yeah, 1984.
1984, in West London, suburb of Brentford. And there's specifically, there's one main eyewitness, this guy named Kevin Chippendale.
Mm-hmm.
And Chippendale was walking home one day, and he claims he looked up in the air, and he saw this creature flying through the air. It appeared to be hundreds of feet up in the air, and it was kind of flying and weaving in and out of some tall apartment buildings. And he later drew a sketch of this thing, and he said that it basically looked like a dog or a cat, because he could see it had four legs and a long tail and I think a cat-like head. And it also had wings. And it was, you know, basically flying. What was really weird is that he said it was kind of flying in a slow motion type of mode. So he saw this on two different occasions from the same location. And this made the local news, and ultimately some other people came forward as well, just a handful that claimed they had seen this thing as well. And what's interesting is in this particular community of Brentford in West, the coat of arms for that community actually has a griffin on there.
Yep,
and
two griffins.
And furthermore, there's a griffin brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's a pub very close to the location where the thing was sighted. And I believe there's also a local soccer stadium there that's known as Griffin Stadium.
It is,
you have
yep.
all of this. You have this kind of motif of griffins in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this manifestation in 1984 of a creature that very much fits the description of a mythological griffin. And now, to my knowledge, there haven't been any sightings since then. So whatever the Brentford Griffin was or is, it's kind of disappeared and faded into obscurity. But it's a great story.
It is. And it's treated as if it were real, at least in the history of Brentford, because Charles II, King of England, now he lived 1630 to 1685. So in the 1600s, he had brought a griffin or given a griffin, supposedly, according to history, to his mistress, Nell Gwynne. And she kept it in captivity, and then one day it fell in the river. I forgot which river it was here, but the River Brent. And they thought it was dead. But then subsequent to that, they found more griffins. Apparently it found another one, and it mated because there were several of them. And then for a long time, there weren't any sightings. It also, I think it was from your article, that a man by the name of Sir Joseph Banks, who was somehow associated with Captain Hook, had brought back a griffin from a Pacific island. And they assumed that the mating took place with this other griffin. I mean, they even back then in the 1600s, they treated it as a real thing.
Wow. Yeah, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. You know, it's a heraldic image, obviously. And griffins, I believe, were protectors, at least in
guardians,
mythology.
Yes.
You know, that just like other gargoyles, you know, they meant to ward off evil spirits or enemies and so forth. So it's interesting, isn't it, how you have all these kind of not so obvious connections. You know, it's a pretty tangled
web, isn't it?
Tangled web. Works,
yeah. Because there were all these associations to Griffin Park.
Exactly.
And the two griffins on the what do you call it, the heraldic,
mm-hmm.
the heraldic.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and then also the apartment building was called the Green Dragon. Green Dragon Apartments.
Yeah, that's true, the Green Dragon Apartments. So, you know, again, going back to one of the theories that we were talking about earlier.
Association,
you know,
and...
Who's to say that this Brentford Griffin was not a construct of, you know, perhaps this gentleman, Kevin Chippendale, maybe...
His mind.
...caused this thing to manifest, and he basically gave it life, gave it physical properties, and then, lo and behold, other people began to see it as well. You know?
Or the reverse could be true, that it, something was actually there, and they finally started picking up on it. It's hard to say, you know, chicken or the egg.
Exactly.
So I found that story really interesting.
I just want to jump in here and say we got about 5 minutes left. Again.
So, okay. So did you have anything else, Ken, that you wanted to bring up? Anything that ever seen yourself?
Have I ever seen that? No, I never have. In all my years of research, I've never... personally seen any of the things that I've, the elusive cryptids that I seek. I do believe that I've heard Bigfoot vocalize
really?
On two or three different occasions, and of course I can't prove it because I didn't see it,
mm-hmm.
but that's what I believe that I heard, because I can't equate what I heard to any other known creature,
mm-hmm.
and I was, of course, in an area where there had been a lot of sightings and activity and stuff. So that's the closest I think I've ever come to experiencing anything myself.
And where was that, Ken? Was that in...
Where was that?
Yeah.
This was at a place called Little Cottonwood Lake, which is in northern Texas, very close to the border with Oklahoma,
okay.
Very remote area, and heard these remarkable sounds emanating from the brush. Several hundred yards away, basically sounded like a grunting primate sound, kind of like an ape would make, like kind of a panting, grunting, almost like a diabolical, deep laughing sound.
Oh, my gosh.
And, the closest thing I could compare it to would be some howler monkeys that I've heard down in Central America.
Oh, creepy.
So, that, and we found some other evidence in that area, some tracks and different things. So, you know, pretty convincing.
Well, you and Lauren both think that, you know, Bigfoot is probably flesh and blood, and I think that's probably true, but do you lend credence to maybe it might be interdimensional somehow?
Well, so a lot of people seem to think that, and there have been accounts of them vanishing into thin air.
Yeah.
Or their tracks vanishing in the middle of nowhere. You know, there's a lot more, you know, there's kind of a, and it's interesting, there's an undercurrent now going on in the Bigfoot community, because you have these two opposing philosophies. Of course, there are the people, more traditional people like me and Lauren, that believe that they are hominids, you know, basically
mm-hmm.
left over from thousands or millions of years ago, and that they're just basically still around, flesh and blood. And then there are those that think that they are somehow interdimensional or spiritual beings.
Yeah, who knows?
They tie it into the... You know, the Nephilim of the Bible and all these different things. So, who knows? But, you know, I don't think that per se. But, you know, anything is possible, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I've got one other question for you. We're almost at the end of the hour. So did you get to meet William Shatner?
No.
No?
You didn't?
No.
Really?
Sadly disappointed. For that particular show, they filmed me up in Point Pleasant, doing the Mothman investigation, and William Shatner films all of his scenes down in California in Hollywood. So
oh, darn.
He doesn't go on location.
I think he's a hoot.
Very unfortunate. But no, I had an opportunity to meet William Shatner. That would have been unbelievable.
That would have been nice.
That would have been good, yeah.
Yeah, he's somebody I'd like to go out and have a beer with.
So, but I thought that was kind of cool that he was actually making fun of me during the course of the show. And,
okay, well, you know, we've come to the end of the hour, Ken. Unfortunately, it always goes by so darn quickly. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me. You guys were awesome. Some great questions. We got in some pretty cool things. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
Oh, we'd love to have you back.
Topics as well.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back again. And thank you very much for joining us. And do you have... website you want to give out, or where people can buy the books?
KenGerhard.com, KenGerhard. If anyone wants to get on there, they can find links to some of my blogs and photos and things.
Great.
I do post my upcoming events. I've also got a Facebook fan page, Ken Gerhard Cryptozoologist. Mm-hmm. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me, get a question or experience or something, I'd love to hear from you.
On Facebook?
Yeah.
Great.
Facebook, or you can email me to my website.
Okay.
All right.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you.
Guys, thanks again for having me on.
Okay, yes, you have a good evening.
We'll,
bye-bye.
We'll have to do it again. Bye-bye. Thank you. Good night. Okay. Now that is Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience.
Another fast hour. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
And good night, and we'll talk to you next week.
In this one.